the many-layered history of the place some call paradise and most call Northampton, Massachusetts. We penetrate the palimpsest of one place through time.
I like that word palimpsest. I've thought a lot about that, and that means literally writing that is erased and then written over so you can see the previous writing. And I used a lot of other people's writing in this book. A lot of Edward's writing, but a lot of other historical figures, as well as fairly anonymous still historical figures, and other writers who had nothing to do with Northampton, whose writing, whose prose simply interested me.
That's Brian Keightley. He's written a fascinating novel about Northampton that combines both a personal history of his own family and the history of place. It's called The River Gods.
So there's these wonderful lyrical passages that Edward talks about. There are far more of those than there are the fire and brimstone sermons that we remember from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
And that's historian Kerry Buckley. Later in the show, we'll talk to him about the collection of essays about the history of Northampton he edited. It's called A Place Called Paradise.
We're on the lower side of the terrace that Fort Hill is situated on, so that to the west of us is the Mill River that Native people called the Kapawanganik.
We'll also take a tour of the Native American landmarks of Northampton with Abenaki storyteller and researcher Marge Bruschak. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the local parlance of Western Massachusetts, the River Gods refers to the group of powerful men who held sway over the business and political life of the towns of the region from the 17th and into the 18th century. Northampton was one of those towns, and it's a setting for my guest Brian Keightley's novel, The River Gods. Written in a series of short vignettes, the novel shifts back and forth in time to reveal glimpses of the town's history as well as the personal history of the author himself, often seen through his eyes as a child. The reader meets the fiery preacher Jonathan Edwards, the husband of accused witch Goody Parsons, Sojourner Truth, and other notable and unknown individuals from Northampton's history. One reviewer called it a luminous, perfectly sculpted novel whose sentences flow as easily through the mind of a 9-year-old boy in 1960s America as they do that of an 18th-century Puritan divine. Brian Keightley teaches creative writing at the University of Denver. The River Gods is his third novel. I started out by asking Keightley what was the inspiration for his book.
The reason I started it in 89 was I'd just come back from Egypt, living in Egypt for 2 years, and Northampton, I stayed in Northampton for about 6 months, and it looked and felt very odd after 2 years in Egypt. The whole country did, but especially in Northampton, my hometown. And I think I was simply exploring what I thought I knew about a place. In historical terms, it stayed for a long time a very historical novel. The family stories, the personal stories kept seeping in, I never trusted them. I actually was a little unnerved to be writing about myself.
Why do you think they kept seeping in?
Not sure, but I finally realized that I was writing historical fiction of all sorts, and I include my own family stories as historical fictions as well, because I know a lot, but I don't know everything about my own past. I was inventing.
Yeah, in fact, you say in the afterword of the book that your personal stories were more fictional than the historical stories.
I felt a great deal of a responsibility for the historical figures, and if I got it wrong, and occasionally when I read the book to audiences, especially here in the Valley, people would question me. I read to the Northampton Historical Society once, and they were sharp, tough questions about what's history and what's fiction, and I couldn't always answer that. So I worried about that. I didn't worry about the stories about myself, my brother, my parents. I knew us. I knew our history. I knew our personalities. So I could relax and create stuff that was very it was fictional, but it was also very accurate, and it reflected a sense of how we'd lived our lives.
The valley you're referring to, for our listeners who are in places other than the valley, is the Pioneer Valley of Western Massachusetts. So let's start with Jonathan Edwards, actually. Tell us who he is, and then the story of his niece and nephew, who were cousins to each other.
Jonathan Edwards was a minister in Northampton at the beginning of the 1700s until, I think, 1740s. He was fired from Northampton in the 1740s. That's a long story, but he was perhaps the first great American writer known, well known outside of the United States, outside of the colonies. My father is a philosopher, and he'd always said that Edwards was the first great American philosopher as well.
And he was a real fire and brimstone guy.
He was that too, but he was very influenced by, I'm maybe getting these wrong, but Locke and a few of the other English philosophers that predate him or were rough contemporaries of his. And he was a brilliant, brilliant mind and a brilliant writer. I love his prose. And that's what eventually drew me into him and made me decide to repeat, work through a few stories around him. He just was so important. That's what he was more to me than the fire and brimstone speaker. He was this great scholar, great studious writer.
And yet he was thrown out of his, by his congregation, out of his church. Edwards Church still exists today. You go into some of the circumstances of that as well.
There's a lot of controversy and not a great deal of hard information about why he was fired. But one of the theories is that he turned the children of the church against parents. It was something like a McCarthy witch trial, real witch trial, searching for sinners, but also witches in a way. I don't think he thought much of that notion of a witch, but he was definitely hoping to get the parents to return to a sense of godliness, which they quickly fell away from. There was the colonial period has a reputation, and Edwards himself has this reputation for being a very, very sincere and frightening preacher. But Americans were very, very quickly becoming ungodly. There's one story I remember. I don't think this is in the book, but there's the walking turnpike from Boston to Northampton had women on the roadside advertising pubs that were off of the road a short distance or a long distance, and they would advertise them by opening up their shirts and showing their breasts to passers-by and say, come to the bar, come to the pub. And that doesn't sound like the New England of Jonathan Edwards that I
the Puritans.
Of. Yes.
And talking about sexuality, I mean, the story that you're talking about, Jonathan Edwards and his niece and nephew, is a very sexualized story. Well, talk a little bit about the sexuality in it. Is this what you're trying to get at, kind of the reality behind the Puritan mask?
I suppose that story came unbidden, and there is no truth to it aside from the character of Edwards that I could discern through his writings and through biographies. Because it was the very first thing I wrote, I wasn't thinking much about it. I just wanted to explore a story, and I had already begun to read about Edwards when I came back from Egypt, so I was aware of him. But I see the whole novel seems to be about sex and death, and they're often intertwined in very odd ways.
Yeah, that's for sure. You mentioned witches, and you talk about Goody Parsons. She's also a very well-known character here. Tell us a little bit about her. What happened to her? Actually, you tell her story from the point of view of her husband.
Well, she was accused of being a witch, one of the few in Northampton, I believe. It wasn't as common a phenomenon as in the eastern part of the state. And the accusation was pure jealousy. Parsons himself was a very successful and early settler in Northampton, one of the first founders of Northampton, of Naugatuck. And he this was in many ways clearly a matter of jealousy of their success and wealth. She apparently did sleepwalk, and that seems to have been the reason she was not convicted. She was actually she did spend 9 months in jail, but not was acquitted finally of the accusations.
And he was one of the river gods. So why don't you tell us who the river gods were?
Well, they were a mix of businessmen, of merchants, and ministers, and the two things often went hand in hand. Edwards himself wasn't a very successful businessman, but a very successful writer and made money off of his writing, but also charged a great deal of the costs of his writing, the paper, even to the church, to the community, and they didn't like that either. That was, you wouldn't think paper would be a terribly expensive thing, but that was one of the reasons he was chastised before he was fired.
So there might have been a bit of a financial incentive to get rid of him.
There was definitely. He was costing too much. He was not, and he was not. He had a very grand house, and he and his wife were not frugal, and that went against the town's thinking. The main reason, finally, though, was he decided at a certain point that members of the church should be decided by him and him alone. He could look into the soul of each church, each person petitioning to become a member of the church. And not everyone, in fact, a relatively small percentage of the town belonged to the church, unlike what we think of as the Puritan era. It was a members-only club, and you had to prove your godliness and your belief in God, your faith. And that is finally what tipped the town against him. They felt he was returning to a very early 70-year prior notion of what a member of the church was and should be.
We're talking with Brian Keightley about his novel, and an unusual novel it is. It's called The River Gods. Now, you keep on saying that this is a novel, and I just mentioned it was unusual. I've never read a novel like this. There seems to be only one narrative arc, if you can even call it that, and that is in your own personal, the figure of Brian Keightley, who we follow from age 7 until through into mid-adulthood. But even there, one wouldn't say that there's a plot. There are many different stories here. Why do you call this a novel and not a collection of short stories?
Because a collection of short stories is anathema to publishers, and novel is not. I do think of it, though, as having a form of overarching narrative. It is not a typical narrative, but it is the history of the town and the situation of Northampton is what holds everything together. I think of there's one line. I'm not sure where in the book. That the original roads of Northampton were laid out by the cows, by the paths that the cattle took, moving from one spot to another, and that's to me one of the issues of Northampton that's very interesting. All of New England, these winding roads that move along hillsides up and down, and those streets, those roads were intimately familiar to me as a kid. Who I never drove while I lived in Northampton until much later, so I walked everywhere, and I saw the town as a very distinct place in a very simple way, a very pedestrian way.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with novelist Brian Keightley about his latest book, The River Gods. Talking about your own personal story here, one of the stories is about your mother. Page 36, I believe it starts. I'd like you to read a little bit, quite a bit from it, if you would. But set us up first. Tell us what's happening here. You know, this seems like it's a dream, but then you deny that it is one. So it's almost a kind of magical realism.
That's a good setup, I'd say. It's close to the beginning of our time in Northampton, and my mother has in my imagining of things, has accepted, and I think they did accept Northampton immediately. We had this lovely two-year period at the faculty housing on Fort Hill, and there was a great group of friends that developed right then and there and stayed friends for the rest of their lives. Ahead on the path is a set of shiny, moving parts, brightened by the moonlight. When I come closer, I see arms and legs and bottoms. It is four or five naked children. One of them looks remarkably like my son, Brian. I once caught him in San Jose, playing doctor with a handful of neighborhood girls. They were all lying flat, side by side, and naked, in the little playhouse. But this can't be Brian. I saw him just minutes ago, sound asleep, covers thrown off. I come close to the children. They are like salamanders in mud. This is obscene, yet it is also like play. The beautiful, lithe bodies hypnotize me. One girl looks up at me with a strange smile on her face. I want to call it a wry smile, but that seems too adult a phrase for this beatific child. Another girl, near this smiling one, opens her mouth, and I smell a skunk, suddenly quite close by. The girl's mouth, open mouth, lets out a deep, raspy voice which says, "We enjoy our sin." I feel myself fall the way one does in sleep, and I have to sit down on wet, heavy mud. I stand up, the mud cold on my thighs and bottom. I wipe off what I can. I say to the children, "Behave yourselves, I beg of you," and I walk away. My mug's in the spot I left it. I climb over the low cement wall on my patio, exactly as I did at the beginning of this journey. I find another pair of pajama bottoms in the hall closet, and I put the soiled ones in the washing machine. I do not start the machine because it will make too much noise, and I want evidence of this in the morning. I make myself another hot milk. I sit on the long couch Brian once covered with the contents of a large Nivea cream jar. He said he was icing a cake. I finish a mystery Murray is reading, starting at the place he dog-eared. I don't read the first 57 pages, but I read with perfect understanding from then on. Slowly dawn comes, creating shadows and color where there were none before. Murray is the first to greet the morning. "Were you up all night?" he asks. I nod, now terribly tired. Was it a dream? I check the washing machine. The mud's still there, and the boys' room. Brian is fast asleep, one leg over the lower bunk bed, snoring lightly. Jeffrey, propped up on his pillow, stares down at me as he often does, with that remarkable combination of childishness and philosophical gravity that both intimidates and delights me. "Is everything all right, Mother?" the 8-year-old asks. "You looked in on us at 3 in the morning. Did you know?" I smile and depart the room without answering. I crawl into my marriage bed and fall asleep instantly.
This is just such an intriguing and haunting story, really. You know, one has shades of Jonathan Edwards there with these children in sin. I wondered if that was one connection that you were making.
Definitely. And a scene prior to what I read, she sees what I think of as ghosts, two people walking in old in costumes that don't fit the time. And across this great open space between all of the buildings that made up the Fort Hill community of apartments, and walking toward the open country, the wild land, to the, I don't know what direction that is, south, I think. So the ghosts, the actual ghosts are these other adults. These kids, I leave it to the reader to decide whether they are, they actually exist, whether she's dreaming, whether she's awake, what she actually saw.
Now, the Brian Keithley of the novel, the younger child, also seems to see a ghost later on in an area I know very well because I lived on Washington Street for a while, and this is probably a block or two away from there. It's over by Smith College. He walks following his older brother and his grandfather into the woods that go along the river that's there, the Mill River, and he sees something quite remarkable. Again, is this real? Is it not?
I don't know.
And did this happen to you, actually? I mean, in the sense, something that you imagined when you were a child.
No, but that landscape, the river on one side are houses. We lived a few blocks from there as well. and on the other side, the state hospital. There were events. There was one particular that was a tiny bit like this, but nothing remotely magical, simply frightening. There was a what we called the baby dam, a small 4-foot or 3-foot dam, and the we would often walk across it. When the river was running relatively low, you could walk across it. There was also a weird contraption along wires that was once used clearly to move things across the river. And on the other side of the river, next to the below the hospital, state hospital, was a small booth with a window in it. And we all crossed one day, and we went up to the booth, and somebody tapped on the window, and then suddenly a man in his pajamas stood up and stared at us. And somebody from the insane asylum, the old state hospital, had gotten loose and was just sitting there, standing there, and nothing happened. He didn't do any, but we ran. We were terrified. So what I was projecting was a different process, I suppose. And I was thinking throughout the book about a lot of ghosts, a lot of characters who live, at least for some of the narrative, and then die but keep telling their story. So they are, all of these are a part of the same phenomenon to me.
Yeah, as I was reading your book, Brian Keightley, The River Gods, a phrase came to me that I often use when I've been living in a place for a long time. I came here to the Pioneer Valley in 1984, and so now it's almost 30 years later. I think of something, I call it the palimpsest of time, that there are layers. You know, as I pass by again and again places that I've been before, the memories of things that have happened before are present and real to me, sometimes even more real than present-day reality. This is something that seemed very much to animate your book, all the layers of time in this city that's now over 350 years old.
I like that word palimpsest. I've thought a lot about that, and that means literally writing that is erased and then written over so you can see the previous writing. And I used a lot of other people's writing in this book. A lot of Edward's writing, but a lot of other historical figures, as well as fairly anonymous still historical figures, and other writers who had nothing to do with Northampton, whose writing, whose prose simply interested me, and I used. Some of this was these were exercises somewhat like the Oulipo writers in France. They're a French group of mathematicians and fiction writers, of all things, who have been designing very difficult exercises. One of them described this as rats designing the mazes out of which they're trying to climb or get. They're very maddening but fascinating, and some of them are really quite beautiful. Italo Calvino is probably the best known of the Oulipo writers. Georges Perec, a French novelist, somebody I know, Harry Matthews, the only American member of the group, lives in Paris. So I was building with other people's prose as much as my own.
Now, in terms of your family too, there's your father Murray, your mother, and your brother Jeffrey, who is very precociously adult and serious in this book. As a child, as an adult, he goes in a very different direction. Talk a little bit about this, and what resemblance does it bear to your real brother's history?
I think a lot. That's a good description of him as a child. He was precocious, unnervingly articulate and smart at a very young age, and I didn't talk until I was about 4. And didn't have to speak very much because Jeffrey, a year and a half older than me, spoke for me and interpreted for me. Was almost like we were twins, one of whom spoke and the other didn't. And I was very active and restless and even perhaps ADD, something like that, before these things were diagnosed. But then in his later life, he did become much more playful, much more restless, and much more active in a physical world, both sexual. He was a gay man living in New York City in the late 70s and early 80s before AIDS, and then life changed. His life changed after AIDS, but he maintained for a while some of that sort of voracious desire, and went to clubs that he would not take me to. I sometimes asked him, but places like the Ramrod and the Anvil, the titles speak for themselves. So he was that, but he also became a great, great chef. And I watched him cook a couple of times, and I was struck by what a physical activity cooking was, chef work, especially in a restaurant where there's no one, and then two tables, and then four tables, and then 10 tables. And the dynamic of it was amazing to me and overwhelming. And he was also just a great cook for us. So we participated in his meals and remember him from his meals.
And he was very political when he was in grade school and high school.
We both were. He was the leader of that. He was the certainly maybe second in command of the McGovern campaign in 1972. He was 16, 17. Lisa Baskin ran the Western Massachusetts McGovern campaign. But Jeff was, I think, she said this to me a number of times. Lisa was Leonard Baskin's second wife and a great.
He's the author and wonderful illustrator, artist.
Mm-hmm. Great artist in his own right, and an illustrator of children's books as well as the Crow poems, Ted Hughes' Crow poems. She was, I think, very indebted to Jeff, and it was fascinating for me to watch him. And go with him around town. Northampton was a fairly easy town to knock on doors, but not entirely. There were people that were very angry with the idea of George McGovern, even in Northampton.
Now, in the book, your brother dies from AIDS. Is this something that actually did happen?
Yes, he died from complications. Unnecessarily, sadly, he had a tumor that, if his doctor had simply touched his stomach when he started complaining about it, he might have lived, and he'd be alive now, because the cocktail of drugs he was taking, just AZT, which by itself was a killer drug, but when the cocktail arrived about it, 6 months or a year later, and when she finally did find the tumor, it was too late. It had grown around his intestines, and it was impossible to remove. And they were worried about his general health by then. So, very sad, very frustrating part of the story. I don't talk about that in the book.
Yes, and tragic.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left. It's a wonderful book, Brian Keightley, The River Gods. I'd like to ask you about if not the last story, very close to the end. You go way back in time. You go back to the year 1062 why don't you tell us where that story is, what it's about?
About a group of Vikings discovering a slightly buried body of a woman who had clearly been beheaded. My notion, I don't know where this came from. I have no historical knowledge of the Vikings. I made that up. But the idea was that the one person has to be selected among the contemporaries who find this body to die, to suffer for her death, because they find what they think is essentially an unsolved murder. And so they decide to condemn one of them to death. I don't say how, but I assumed it was through drawing of lots, and they have to take him back to the ocean, and they in a sense just let him drift out to sea without water and to die there. The reason it ends the book more or less is that there was once a time when the book moved from the present progressively backwards in time to the past, and I wanted some vestige of that. I finally realized that didn't work, nor did it moving straight forward from that moment to the 1990s. But I liked the notion of having it as a memorial to an earlier draft of the novel.
Brian Keightley, In addition to his latest novel, The River Gods, Brian Keitley is the author of two other novels, Still Life with Insects and I Know Many Songs, But I Cannot Sing. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The River Gods. Next up, a tour of native Northampton and a panoramic view of the history of the town Jenny Lind called Paradise. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A few years ago, in the dead of winter, Abenaki storyteller and scholar Marge Bruschak took me on a fascinating tour of what might be termed Native Northampton, the places and traces where the Native Algonquian tribes of the region made their home at a great bend of the Connecticut River. That's where later the English colonialists founded the town Northampton. Bruschak took me first to Fort Hill, the very neighborhood where Brian Keitley lived as a child and that figures in his novel, The River Gods. There, Bruschak revealed the outlines of the native settlement under the modern town, a place that's been settled for 12,000 years.
We're on the lower side of the terrace that Fort Hill is situated on, so that to the west of us is the Mill River that Native people called the Kapawanganik. The English settlement was allowed to settle on the western side of the Mill River, which is also on the western side of the Quinnecticut or the Connecticut River, to facilitate trade. But Native people continued to use the cornfields to the south of us in the meadows and fields that are now below what we call Hospital Hill. So the interesting thing about the placement of a Native fort in this general area is that you have very easy access to the river, very easy access to your corn planting fields, and you just hop across the water to the trading post. You also get to keep a very close eye on the English settlement there. The reason it has the name Fort Hill, there are locations all through this valley that go by the name of Indian Hill, Indian Fort, etc. And what most of those represent are places where there were Native communities who, after European contact, built some kind of fortified settlement, in part to be close to a trading post, in part because of the intertribal wars that were going on. This Fort Hill was constructed specifically by the Nonotuc in order to facilitate trade with John Pynchon at Northampton. The Nonotuc Fort was built in 1664, about 30 years after William Pynchon had established a trading post at Springfield, and then William's son, John Pynchon, was engaged in trade at Northampton with Native people from farther north. And the Nonotuc specifically built that fortified settlement to be closer for the fur trade. But Pynchon compelled them to adhere to specific conditions while they lived in the fort, and these included, quote, "They shall not break the Sabbath by working or gaming or carrying burdens. They shall not powwow on that place or anywhere else amongst us. They shall not take in Indians of other places to seat amongst them. We allow only Nawadog Indians that were the inhabitants of that place."
Marge Bruschak explained that the word Norwadic or Nonotuc, both names of this place, referred to a phrase meaning in the midst of the river.
And it doesn't refer to islands in the midst of the river, but it refers to the settlements on either side of the place where the river does its oxbow. And that oxbow has shifted over time. And one reason for the thick settlement here is that the alluvial lands it built up were so rich for farming. So it was especially concentrated settlement when there were cornfields here. And the confusion among Indian names is really interesting because in this valley, virtually all of the names that we use as tribal names are actually locative terms. They're place names. So one possibility that the records seem to bear out is that the Nonotuc, Pocumtuck, Agawam, Warnoco, etc., were all very closely related. And they may not have actually viewed themselves as separate tribes, but as separate, distinct tribal communities that were all engaged in similar activities and similar relations. And we know there was a great deal of intermarriage between them. And after colonial settlement is when they really worked together. And what we see consistently is that these tribes always hung together in resisting English settlement.
Next, we headed for Hospital Hill, where the state mental hospital used to be, and some of its imposing structures still stand. We did the tour in the middle of the winter. You can hear our boots crunching on the icy snow underfoot.
You look around, here's the river behind us. We're standing in the middle of Nonotuc cornfields. We're looking at this nice, you know, glacial came that's perfect for a settlement. There are springs behind there, so you've got good sources of fresh water. We've also got the evidence of cornfields that persisted right into the 1920s and 30s down here. But now it's just a playground. We're walking on what's called Pancake Plain. Flat.
Right. And this is where the Indian cornfields were.
Mm-hmm. One reason to get to this part of the hill is that you can get some sense of the lay of the land. And you can also see how this whole valley is carved out like a bowl. We're standing on what's now called Hospital Hill. We're looking down at a large flat area, but looking across, we can see parts of the Holyoke Range. If we were to gaze towards the north, we would see other hills in the distance. This valley was created by a great glacier that came through here. When the glacier melted, it filled the valley with water. When it receded, it left behind much of the resistant rock and a lot of glacial formations. So you have, and then as the rivers come through the valley, so all of the rivers, the Connecticut River, the what's now called the Deerfield River, the Mill River, all of these rivers meander through this valley, depositing silt over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years until you have very rich bottomlands, very well-drained terraces, and just perfect areas for settlements and habitation. So when Native people lived here, what you would find is clusters of communities on the bottomlands, sometimes hills on the terraces, and trails connecting all of them. By about 2,000 years ago, there was a lot of intensive maize agriculture here. When Europeans first looked at this valley, it seemed ideal for European settlement for that same reason. But it also had, by and large, already been cleared, because Native people would burn over the forest periodically to both clear some areas for travel, to encourage browse, to encourage deer and other populations, and then also cleared areas for corn planting.
The traces of Native American life are to be found in the Yankee culture that succeeded it.
Much of what we think of today as Yankee lifeways is actually Native lifeways, Algonquian Indian in particular. The simplest one is corn. Corn is an indigenous plant from this part of the world. Maple sugar, the styles of farming, the kind of use of lands, the travel, the trails, even roads like 91 are built on what were once Indian trails, travel on the riverways facilitated by canoe, travel during winter facilitated by toboggans and snowshoes. So a lot of Native technology was adopted straight into Yankee culture. And just the way of situating, I mean, even the simplest thing of situating home sites where there were already existing Native home sites. So in many ways, when you think about it, the layout of what we think of as New England was heavily influenced by the ways in which Native people used the land. But again, that's why we have that sense that it's so hard to see Native presence, because I often tell people if you want to find the densest evidence of Native habitation, you're going to have to dig under the oldest English towns.
A tour of Native Northampton with Marge Bruschak. She's the co-author of the book 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving, published in 2001. Bruschak contributed a chapter to a marvelous collection of historical essays about Northampton that were gathered into the book A Place Called Paradise. It came out in 2004, the year the town celebrated its 350th anniversary. I spoke that year with the book's editor, Kerry Buckley. He's the executive director of Historic Northampton, a museum of regional history and culture from the contact period to the present. The enthusiasm with which his book was received showed Kerry Buckley that there is what he calls a hunger for authenticity in the public. I asked him what he means by that.
There's that hunger is to kind of touch the actual, the real, because our historical imaginations are full of inauthentic images that we get from Hollywood, Disneyland, or other kinds of things. And we kind of know that. And to try to get back to a sense of the real, the authentic, I think is something that everyone likes to connect to.
I know that I flipped through the various paintings of Northampton and photographs of Northampton in its various incarnations with that idea of wanting to see what it was like, mm-hmm. this community that I've lived in for so many years. What was it like before I was here?
Yes. Yeah. Right. And how other people saw it, how other people viewed it. I think that's one of the striking things about the Valley is that it has inspired visions, whether it's artistic or literary, that have been expressed over the years. I mean, from the very, very beginning, there was a palpable sense that the physical geography of the place was something special, something different that set it apart from other places. In 1760, Reverend Peter Coffin climbed to the summit of Mount Holyoke and said, "This is a beautiful garden laid out before us." And other people, certainly painters, artists like Thomas Cole, saw the same thing.
You also give the origin of the name Paradise Valley. Mm. Could you say something about that? And what is so paradisical of this valley?
The notion of paradise, actually there was a geographical spot in Northampton called Paradise. The Paradise Pond is an old name, Paradise Road. There was another little area along the Mill River called Paradise, where one of the first baseball games in Northampton and, you know, one of the early games was played, the baseball field called Paradise. Frederick Douglass played baseball there. We see it cropping up in diaries and letters in the 1820s, the 1830s. But when Jenny Lind came here in the 1850s, it was the famous quote, "This is the paradise of America," and it, that sort of stuck.
You mentioned Frederick Douglass. Mm. There's quite a history of Northampton in the abolition movement. Mm-hmm. Could you say something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Northampton was the center of one of the utopian communities that proliferated in Massachusetts in the years before the Civil War. But it was unique in the sense that it was philosophically a Garrisonian abolitionist community, anti-slavery abolitionist community. And it was also organized around the communal owning and operation of a silk mill. So it was an industrial community based on these abolitionist sentiments. And drew abolitionists like Frederick Douglass to speak there. It drew Sojourner Truth, who became a member of that community. And as an aside, we discovered a series of letters written by members of that community which talk about Sojourner Truth in real life. She is as big as her legend is in real life, as seen by the members of that community. And it really comes through in those letters. And those have been published in a volume called Letters from an American Utopia that came out a little bit before this book. But just to go in a little bit about abolitionism, I mean, Northampton was also a spa for Southern planters. The Round Hill Hotel was a stopping off place, a watering spot for people like Stonewall Jackson and families who brought their slaves with them. And there was a lot of contention. You see court cases where people from Northampton would try to get the slaves to leave their masters and so forth, a number of cases like that. There are also other abolitionist movements which were far more conservative than the Garrisonians. Women were not allowed to speak in public in these meetings and didn't really have a kind of a role that we find for women and people of color in the Northampton Association. So it was radical in many respects. But it was certainly a time of conflict because, as Lydia Maria Child said, who also lived here before the Civil War, this was a cold valley to a certain extent. There are many merchants who were tied to the tourism Southern planters, and one family actually moved to Alabama and operated a plantation with over 1,000 slaves from Northampton. So there's like the rest of the nation, Northampton was part of the kind of the mix of feelings and motivations that eventually led to national conflict.
You know, the German writer Klaus Mann, the son of Thomas Mann, said once that each human being is at once unique and representative. Mm-hmm. And I kept on thinking about that as I read this book. I wonder if you could talk about both parts of that. What was the distinct regional culture of Northampton, mm-hmm. and how is it representative of the larger culture?
I think that's very insightful, and that's something that my reading of Northampton history has certainly borne out, because it is exactly that. You can see the sort of the larger sweep of American history through so many of the individual case studies that these chapters represent. Northampton always had a distinct culture of its own. It was essentially the quote unquote first frontier for Europeans. The Great Migration in 1636 brought a number of Europeans who sort of skipped the interior of Massachusetts and settled the Connecticut River Valley. William Pynchon founding Springfield in 1636, and Northampton was really an extension of his empire to a certain extent. I mean, it was part of the fur trade that was very lucrative. And the orientation of Northampton has always been up and down the Connecticut River Valley, and a distinctive architecture, a distinctive culture has really characterized the region. And certainly artists, painters, and writers have found something distinctive here. Mm-hmm. I mean, even today, I think economically, this region has more in common with the New York metropolitan region than it does historically with Boston in the East. And there's that political conflict between East and West reflected in Shays' Rebellion and many other things that you can probably see reflected in politics today.
What did the place symbolize for those who lived here, do you feel, and who wrote about it?
Mm-hmm. When you're looking at diaries, manuscripts, and so forth, what we tend to forget is that we're looking back in hindsight, and that people, of course, who lived were as we are today. We can't foresee the future. We're innocent of things to come. And so I think that each generation saw itself as unique in a certain sense. Those that lived in the abolitionist community were innocent of the bloodshed that was to come in the Civil War. So I think most people saw themselves caught up with their circumstances of daily life. Those that lived in colonial times didn't sit around the firesides spinning and saying, boy, are we lucky to live in this pre-industrial community, because they had conflicts, hardships, tremendous uncertainty that we would find a burden to bear today. But there are some who were able to step back to look at themselves in the wider community. I mean, I think Jonathan Edwards, for example, saw this as sort of a stage where God's drama of redemption was acted out. He was inspired by the natural setting. He loved the mountains. He would ride out on his horse into the meadows, and he would sort of jot down notes for his sermons on little scraps of paper. Paper was fairly scarce, and he would pin them to his cloak and ride back, literally covered with thoughts. And his wife, Sarah, would take the notes and file them away for his sermons. So there's these wonderful lyrical passages that Edward talks about there are far more of those than there are the fire and brimstone sermons that we remember from Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Yet he was certainly aware of the environment, the beauty, and also, the foibles of human nature that he did not hesitate to talk about from his pulpit every Sunday.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with historian and museum director Kerry Buckley about the book he edited, A Place Called Paradise. It's a collection of essays about the history of Northampton, Massachusetts, from the time the native peoples lived here and called it Nanotuck to the 20th century. This is Writer's Voice. So this was at least somewhat of an earthly paradise for him?
Well, that's interesting. Probably paradoxically it was, because he probably spent the happiest years of his life here. Yet Edwards, of course, was one who saw the world as just a thin tissue over the spiritual reality where there was a conflict between good and evil involving everyone. So he probably was a little careful not to take his vision of reality as an explanation of his world. You find that in Hawthorne, for instance, as well, who young Goodman Brown and some of the others, where what appearance is not always reality, and that was certainly part of the Puritan mindset.
The Transcendentalists later on also,
mm-hmm.
would they have come into that tradition in the same way?
Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned some of the artists as well. I mean, they're part of that period, that kind of romantic period, and it's very interesting. Northampton was one of the earliest tourist destinations. And people would the view from Mount Holyoke was one of the must sees of the 1820s and 1830s, and it was popularized by painters like Thomas Cole, his view of the Oxbow from the top of Mount Holyoke, and many other of his imitators down the road. But it's interesting that this kind of bucolic view of the valley came at about the time when America was undergoing the process of industrialization. So the valley became the epitome of the picturesque, which was the perfect balance between wild nature on one side and corrupt civilization on the other. It was the middle landscape, the cultivation, prosperity, and a setting of natural beauty. And so it became embodied in paintings like Thomas Cole. And of course, it was a romantic image. It wasn't the reality at all, because in the landscape of some of those romantic paintings, you see a little wisp of smoke that might mean a train or a factory or something like that, a little bit of modernity kind of intruding in the scene.
Now, you don't only write about the great individuals or figures like Jonathan Edwards. You also focus a lot of the book on, as you say, giving voice to those who didn't write things down, mm-hmm. ordinary folks. And you talk about the texts that are embedded in material culture.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, every object, in a sense, tells a story. And historical museums are different than art museums, let's put it that way. Historical museums have more labels. Just joking. But if you've ever been frustrated by going into an art museum and seeing a label on something very interesting that says 600 BC, you want to know more. So historical museums are about objects that are on display because of their historical significance, not because they represent a certain example of a genre or this or that. So an object comes with, at least in our collection, letters, diaries, photographs. For instance, we have one of the most extensive costume and textile collections in the Northeast. But it's unique in the sense that we have, for instance, bolts of cloth that a certain costume or dress was made from, and maybe a diary telling about how that cloth was purchased, why the dress was made, sort of the accessories along with that, a photograph. So this allows historians to kind of put together a picture of the reality of daily life, the story that are embedded in these objects. And Marla Miller does a great job of bringing out the female artisans in the colonial period that are sort of that don't really show up in the text that we associate with artisanship in colonial America. But she looks at the diaries, at the materials, and comes up with a very vibrant picture of a culture and a way of life that has escaped historians because they didn't look closely enough at the objects and the material that are really hiding in plain sight.
What do you feel that those objects can say to us today?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the goals that I had for this collection was to create a kind of a multidimensional text, kind of a portal for each chapter. And when you say objects, I'm going to talk about documents as well, primary sources. And we decided to sort of experiment with a model with one of the chapters that we hope to replicate with all of them. One of my favorite chapters is the one on the Goody Parsons witchcraft case that John Demos wrote. Came from his prize-winning book, Entertaining Satan.
That's called Hard Thoughts and Jealousies.
Hard Thoughts and Jealousies. It's a wonderful example of what you can do with a slice of local history to a certain extent, because really what this story talks about, yes, it's a kind of a he said, she said kind of local spat, but it talks about the rise and the parallel fortunes of families that came over from England in the Great Migration, the sort of the rise and of one and the fall of another, and how it resonated with community tensions over a witchcraft scandal. But what we did with that chapter is we developed a website that took all of the primary 17th century primary documents that John Demos used in his chapter, together with virtual exhibits, and put them online together with transcriptions. And so what you can do, you can actually go there and read the 17th century trial transcripts, look at the probate inventory, and really replicate the research that Demos did and go off on your own direction.
Northampton and its surroundings have always been a hotbed of independent, even radical, thinking. From Shay's Rebellion to today's activism around protecting the environment and promoting local economies. Carrie Buckley was reminded of this when
we received a publication of that was printed in 1812 in Hampshire County, which just astonished me because I knew that Massachusetts and New England opposed the War of 1812 and almost seceded from the Union over that. But there were 80 delegates to a convention in 1812. And the letter to President Madison, the refusal to send troops to support the war in 1812, and the accusations of starting a war on false pretenses resonated very loudly to the present. That's another again, this is in 1812, which is 2 years before the Hartford Convention, that there was such strong sentiment.
So a rebellious nature has been part of the history of this valley.
Well, you might say that, yes. To put it into context, it probably had a more vocal presence in the valley than elsewhere, although same tensions were probably simmering in other places. Yeah, there's always been a whiff of Bohemia in the air of Northampton, I think, and rebelliousness as well. Certainly political consciousness was very high.
Carrie Buckley of the Museum Historic Northampton. We spoke to him several years ago about the book he edited of historical essays about the town, A Place Called Paradise. You can go to Writer's Voice for a link to the museum's website, and you can find out there about the Goody Parsons witch trial, as well as a whole lot more information about Northampton history. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.